AC Ocean Law versus American Guarantee and Liability Insurance Company. If counsel could please step forward. Please have appearances of counsel.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justices. Stephen M. Orlovsky, Blank Rome, LLP, appearing for petitioner AC Ocean LLP. With me this morning are my partners and colleagues, Mr. Lavella and Mr. Berman, who have been admitted pro hoc vici, also with Blank Rome, LLP.
Thank you.
Nicholas and Sua of Reed Smith, who are the amicus curiae of United Policy.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Dave Roth for Defendant American Guarantee and Liability Insurance Company.
Good morning, Your Honor. Keith Moskowitz on behalf of AIG Specialty Insurance Company.
And good morning, Your Honors. Brett Solberg on behalf of Interstate Fire and Cattle.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Orlovsky, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. Mr. Chief Justice, may I reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal?
10 is more than we usually grant.
So in that case, Your Honor, I will follow Shakespeare's admonition that brevity is the soul of wit.
We'll have you back for hopefully a little less than 10. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This court has before it, as I'm sure you're aware, voluminous briefs submitted by the parties and the various amici. Please allow me to take a few moments this morning to penetrate the fog of hyperbole surrounding the three issues on which this court has granted certification. First, let me begin by telling you what this case is not about. Defendants have taken what I call the, quote, scoreboard, close quote, approach. They have cited many state and federal cases from around the country which have decided these questions against policyholders. Those cases, while certainly entitled to consideration, are not dispositive. First of all, federal courts under our federal system can only predict what the law of a state may be if the Supreme Court of that state has not decided the issue. Second, while decisions of the Supreme Courts of other states are certainly entitled to consideration, they too are not dispositive. Why, you ask, is that? Because long before the pandemic, there was well-settled New Jersey case law in the field of insurance law, which governed what occurred here and what these policies mean. In short, the pandemic changed many things in our lives, but it didn't change the law, the New Jersey law of insurance. And finally, the other thing to remember here is that insurance policies are contracts of adhesion, and ambiguities in insurance contracts must be resolved in favor of the insured. So the first question the court granted certification on was, does printing mark permit New Jersey courts to adjudicate factual disputes at the pleading stage, such as determining that the coronavirus cannot physically alter a property's airspace or surfaces, that the virus is easily wiped away, and that the virus is threatened or actual presence cannot render property unusable, contrary to the allegations in a plaintiff's complaint? The short answer to that question is no. In the complaint, Ocean Walk made numerous factual allegations about the cause of the loss and what the virus did to its property. The appellate division not only disregarded these allegations, but in some cases actually found facts to the contrary. Now, and more importantly, the pandemic did not change the rules of court, and in particular, did not change Rule 4:6-2E. That rule has been generously applied by this court for many years since the seminal case of Printing Mart was decided. Under Printing Mart, as this court is aware, a trial court must search the complaint in depth and with liberality to ascertain whether the fundament of a cause of action may be gleaned even from an obscure statement of a claim. And the allegations of the complaint are assumed to be true. And the plaintiff is given the benefit of all reasonable inferences to be derived from the complaint. In this case, Judge Winkelstein, a retired, well-respected judge of the appellate division on recall, did just that. The appellate division did not. The appellate division's cursory and conclusory review of the allegations of the complaint ignores the printing mark standard. And I think it's important to note, because for some reason, in reading many of the briefs here, I read a lot about Rule 12b-6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, a rule with which I'm very familiar. But I want to make it clear that this case is not governed by 12b-6 or by Twombly and Iqbal. It's governed by Rule 4:6-2, and I think that's important. Yet the appellate division ignored the allegations of the complaint, disregarded them, and in some cases made factual findings contrary to the allegations. Obviously the function of the appellate division is not to make any factual findings. And as Judge Winkelstein noted in his opinion, the defendants may disagree with the allegations of the complaint, but that disagreement is for another day, not on a motion to dismiss.
Mr. Orlovsky, if one of the allegations of the complaint is that the damage that your clients allege is within the coverage as it's described in the insurance policy, is that something that the court has to assume the truth of under printing mark? And I say that because if that is so, it seems to me that there could never be a dismissal at the pleading stage of any coverage allegation.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that Rule 4.6e2 changes because we're talking about an insurance contract.
My question is this. If the allegation of the complaint is that a particular loss is within the coverage language, and I'm just saying this very generally, of an insurance policy, is that the sort of allegation that must be assumed to be true under printing mark?
I don't see why not.
So there could never, as long as an insured alleges that their loss is within the coverage as described in the insurance policy, then there can never be a motion to dismiss. And well, I say that because it seems to me that many coverage disputes are resolved at the motion to dismiss stage. And I'm not talking about 12b-6. I'm talking about our New Jersey rule for motions to dismiss.
Well, Your Honor, let's focus on this case. In this case, Ocean alleged that the air and surfaces on its property were affected by the coronavirus. That's an allegation which has to be assumed to be true for purposes of ruling on a motion to dismiss. And that's an allegation that's within the coverage language of the policy.
So you're saying that all an insured has to do to defeat a motion to dismiss is to state the language of the insurance policy and say our loss, which is clearly described, it's a COVID-related loss of business, is within that coverage language, and that defeats the motion to dismiss. Is that all an insured has to do?
If the complaint properly pleads a loss that's within the coverage language of the policy, then the allegations which are advanced in the complaint must be assumed to be true. That's not a decision. It's not a decision for the trial court or for the appellate division to question the accuracy or the validity or the truth of those allegations.
But you agree that it's only factual allegations and not legal allegations or
conclusions
that have to be presumed true?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So would the definition of physical loss or physical damage within a particular insurance policy be a question of fact or a question of law?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor, because it can be both. It can be both. For example, the We're talking about direct physical loss or damage. And so we've alleged that the surfaces in the air and the air within the casino facilities were affected by the coronavirus. We're also alleging a direct damage. Now that can be a question of law, but I don't think that the complaint can be dismissed on a motion to dismiss, because ultimately whether there is a direct damage loss has to be determined ultimately by the case law.
So you say that your loss, if the court is the court in a position to determine whether the loss that you describe is within the covered language of the insurance policy or not on a motion to dismiss?
I think so, Your Honor. I think that the court has to assume those allegations to be true. Judge, on a motion to dismiss, the defendant can certainly move to dismiss when saying that under as a matter of law, there's no coverage. Because
it seems to me you have allegations of fact in terms of what the losses were, and you have allegations that it is within the covered within the coverage language of the insurance policies. You have both of those categories of allegations.
There are two basic allegations in the complaint. One is that the surfaces and air space within the casino facilities were affected and altered by the coronavirus. And the second allegation is that, with respect to damage, is that the casino, because of the presence of the coronavirus, the casino lost the effective use of its facilities, similar to the ammonia case, or in some cases, the asbestos case, where the asbestos is of such an intense concentration that it makes the facility unusable.
Your colleagues point out that the closure and the opening were keyed to the executive orders, that your client had to shut its doors with the first executive order, and it reopened as soon as the revised executive order permitted it to do so. To what extent may that be considered?
Well, first of all, let me make it clear that we are not seeking coverage based on the closure orders issued by Governor Murphy.
Yes, but the argument, of course, is that it is the closure order that brought about the losses to your client.
Well,
to what extent may that be considered at this point?
Well, I don't think it can be. Well, that, it seems to me that that's a defense that they're asserting, but I don't think that defense can be adjudicated on a motion to dismiss. It seems to me that that's something, if we make the allegations and put on proofs, that the defendants can then put on proofs. Well, you say that's why you closed, but they're perfectly capable of making this defense themselves. But what they would likely say is that, well, you may be saying that, but the reason you really closed was because of Governor Murphy's closure orders. That's a disputed issue which can't be resolved on a motion to dismiss. Okay.
What is the factual allegation that your client is making, that the casinos and the other facilities were closed because there was surface contamination unrelated to the closure orders that I think undisputably applied to those facilities?
Okay, just give me a moment, Your Honor. There are several allegations which address that point. They may be found at DA 22, paragraph 3. Oceanwalk's operations have been and continue to be suspended and threatened by the ongoing and increasingly dangerous conditions created by the coronavirus epidemic. There's an allegation at DA 31, paragraph 66, Oceanwalk reasonably expected the defendant insurers to provide coverage, whereas here the risk of threat of harm.
Slow down if you would.
I'm sorry?
Slow down if you would.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Oh, no problem.
Let me start again.
No, just the DA 66. I missed.
Okay. Let's go back to DA paragraph 66. Oceanwalk reasonably expected the defendant insurers to provide coverage, whereas here the risk or threat from harm from coronavirus to persons or property caused Oceanwalk to suffer loss by being deprived of physical use of the property. DA 43, paragraph 119, the virtually guaranteed risk of significant harm and damage to persons and property is why it became necessary to limit or close the use of indoor spaces, such as the Ocean Casino Resort, as well as nearby properties that also attract customers to Oceanwalk's premises. DA 45, paragraph 130, commencing on or about March 16, 2020, Oceanwalk was required to suspend operations at its covered premises as a result of the risks associated with the coronavirus pandemic, including direct physical loss of or damage to covered property and in compliance with government guidance and orders. We had to comply with the government orders. There was no choice about that, but that's not the basis upon which we're seeking coverage. And so the two concepts, the closure required by government, by Governor Murphy's executive orders, was something that we had to comply with as a matter of law. But we're alleging more than that, that the closure, that we would have been required to close the facilities even without Governor Murphy's executive orders. And that's an allegation that maybe, as Judge Winkelstein pointed out, you know, the allegations may be factually disputed, but that dispute is for another day. It's not to be adjudicated on a motion to dismiss.
Did the closures coincide with the orders? Did the timing of the closures coincide with the orders? In other words, did your client close the facilities in accordance with the closure orders when the government required them to be closed?
Justice, I don't know the answer to that question. They happened at or about the same time.
And then wasn't the closure order, I'm sorry.
Wasn't the casino closed on March 16th of 20?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Reopened on July 2nd of 20?
I think that's correct,
which
yes.
Coincided precisely with the dates.
It did, yes, it did. But I think that's what happened, yes. Let me move on.
Asbestos.
Sorry?
You have referred to the asbestos case, but it seems that in the Port Authority decision, the Third Circuit held, when the presence of large quantities of asbestos in the air of a building is such as to make the structure uninhabitable and unusable, then there's been a distinct loss to the owner. But if asbestos is present in components of a structure, but it is not in such form or quantity as to make the building unusable, the owner has not suffered a loss. Is your allegation that whether or not the building was actually rendered unusable is a question of fact that has to be decided?
Yes.
At a motion to dismiss phase?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our contention. I don't see how it can be, it's an allegation and it's disputed. And we would be obligated to prove it, and obviously the defendants would take the position that we can't prove it, or it wasn't, you know, that the concentrate, similar to the asbestos case, that the amount of coronavirus in the airspace did not require complete closure.
You've alleged that the damage caused by the coronavirus, physically remaining on an altering property for extended periods of time, was remedied at exactly the time the governor's executive order said you could reopen. And I'm assuming your response would be, to the extent there's any connection there, that has to wait for a later determination.
That's correct. And by the way, Judge, one of the things, and I say this with respect both to this court and to the appellate division, judges and justices don't sit as scientists. And there's an amicus brief filed by the Medical Society of New Jersey, which talks about some of the science surrounding the coronavirus, and that it cannot, and the appellate division, for example, found that the coronavirus could be easily removed with household cleaners. That's not true. It cannot. And it's much more difficult to remove it, and it can linger for days and a period of weeks. And it's a, you know, it's an area of evolving science. And I think that the case that we should be allowed to proceed through discovery and present expert testimony about that. And I think that the appellate division was clearly wrong in making that determination.
The day before the closures were ordered by Governor Murphy, the casino was operating. Is that correct?
Sorry.
The casino was operating. The other facilities were operating.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
And was that based upon a determination by your client? Is your allegation that was based on a determination by your client that on that day it was safe to operate?
Yes.
And the day after that is the day the order came in. Is it your client's contention that it stopped operating based upon a determination that it was no longer safe to operate?
I think it was both. I think that there was...
Both what?
But I think it was both the closure order and the concern that the impact that the virus was having on the physical surfaces and the air.
So the day before, it was your client's contention that it was safe to operate, and the day after, with the closure order in place, there's a different determination as to safety. Is that the allegation?
Well, Judge, these things happen. Remember, these things happen pretty quickly for all of us in March of 2020.
No, of course, everyone experienced.
And everybody was confused. Everybody was trying to sort out what the coronavirus
right.
was.
No, I get that. Everybody.
And so I can't pinpoint for you when the decisions were made and how they were made. What I'm saying now, and we're saying, and obviously the complaint was pled and filed after March of 2020. All of those.
I'm not asking for a factual representation, Mr. Orlovsky. I'm asking for what is the allegation that you are making here with respect to the distinction between the last day that before the closure that your client was operating and the day it closed.
Well, Judge, I don't think that you can. I don't want to confuse the closure order with the decision to close the facility because of the concern that the virus was having on the surfaces and the air of the casino facilities. And
but
on its ability to stay open.
Those dates coincide. And
I'm sorry?
But those dates coincide with each other. And even the paragraph that you read, paragraph 130 of the complaint, it says that Oceanwalk was required to suspend operations on March 16th, 2020.
That's a statement of fact. We were.
Because of the closure orders.
Well, we had no choice whether we agreed with the closure order or not. We had to suspend operations.
Right. Just as operations suspended in the private sector and the public sector all over New Jersey and all over the country at that time.
Right.
But is it your allegation that the closure order was not the reason your client closed?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't just that. We had no choice. We had no choice when the governor issued the order, and I'm not challenging the merits of the governor's order or whether the governor had a basis to issue the order.
Does your client challenge the assertion that it closed when it did and reopened when it did because the order was imposed and that it was rescinded?
Well,
we think that.
We have alleged that it was more than the closure order, and we think that's an issue that has to be adjudicated factually and can't be adjudicated on a motion to dismiss. Let me turn to the second question. The second question on certification is, are allegations that insured property was physically damaged by the presence of the coronavirus or rendered essentially unusable by the risk of the coronavirus sufficient to allege, quote, direct physical loss or damage to covered covered property? The answer to that question is yes. Here, Oceanwalk alleged that its property was physically altered by the coronavirus. By the way, I don't think the defendants disagree that physical alteration doesn't constitute physical damage. But the appellate division, in our view, improperly rejected those allegations. And secondly, with respect to the question of direct physical loss. There was certainly pre-pandemic law, which held that physical loss included, among other things, loss of essential function or property being rendered uninhabitable. And the cases, we can go through all the cases, but I'm sure the court's familiar with customized distribution, Wakefern, Gregory Packaging, and Port Authority. All of those cases, to one degree or another, address the question of whether property has lost its essential function or has been rendered uninhabitable.
There are two separate tests, whereas, so you're alleging that Wakefern and customized distribution say that it's loss of essential function, but then the Third Circuit case says that it's totally uninhabitable. Are you saying that's actually the same? Loss of
essential function equals
totally uninhabitable?
Well, they're not the same, but they're, you know, let me say it's just another string to our bow, if you will, that the Third Circuit in the asbestos case in Port Authority essentially held that if the concentration of asbestos was of such a high degree, it would render the property uninhabitable. And that's certainly, you know, and that's certainly now one part of the allegation. And I think the ammonia case where there was ammonia somehow infused the property and it became, at least for a period of time, became uninhabitable and unusable for its essential purpose. I think that's essentially what we're talking about here.
Both of those cases, though, talk about the property owner needing to complete repairs in order to remove the asbestos, in order to remove the ammonia. What were the repairs that are alleged to have been completed here?
Well, first of all, it's not clear, and I think the science is still evolving, about how to remove the coronavirus from the facility, because the appellate division said incorrectly that it could be the coronavirus could be removed from surfaces with ordinary household cleaning, and it can't. That's just inaccurate. And I think there's a discussion in the amicus brief by the Medical Society of New Jersey, which talks about removal of the coronavirus from surfaces. And that, by the way, is an evolving science, and there's going to be expert testimony about what the remediation efforts have to be.
But what are the factual allegations as to what remediation or remedial measures you undertook in order to be able to reopen on July 2nd? So this already happened. It's not, you know, in theory, in the future, what should the remediation measures be? The building has already reopened. And at that point, presumably, your clients had judged that it was no longer uninhabitable. So I'm asking, what were the remedial measures taken to make it no longer uninhabitable?
I don't think we allege the specific details of what they did. But what they did was they did the best they could under the circumstances to deal with the coronavirus. And at the time, you know, there were a variety of different, you know, they were using air filtration systems to clean the air. They were using, you know, industrial strength cleaners, whatever that means, to try to remove it from the surfaces at the casino.
So does your client allege that they reopened because they remediated?
Well, I don't think they would have reopened if they didn't feel that they had remediated.
But is it your client's contention that the reason they were in a position to reopen on the date they reopened was because they had remediated?
Well, I think yes. To the extent that remediation was capable of being performed at the time back in 2020, and you know what the remediation what effective remediation techniques were, or ones that they used. They did the best that they could under the circumstances.
And does your client assert that the reopening on July 2nd was unconnected to the executive order?
If Governor Murphy had not lifted the order, they couldn't have reopened. In other words, if the order, regardless of whether they had effectively remediated, if the governor had not vacated his order to reopen, they couldn't have opened.
Does your client assert that it was its successful efforts at remediation that enabled it?
I don't think they would have reopened solely because the governor lifted the order, unless they felt that to the extent possible, using the technology available to them at the time, that they had effectively remediated the premises.
Why doesn't the contamination exclusion apply?
Okay. So that addresses the third question that was on which the court granted certification. And Judge Winkelstein felt or held that that the contamination exclusion of three of the carriers was barred by Navitz. And he points out, and he says it at some length, that the analysis articulated by Justice Wallace in Navitz is similar, that the pollution exclusion clause in this case for three of the carriers were overly broad, unfair, and without doubt contrary to objectively reasonable expectations of the insured. Now, what the carriers did was they inserted the term virus in the section defining contamination, but in the definition of contaminant, they did not include the word virus. So
where does the word contaminant actually appear in the policy?
Hold on a second.
I'm reading section 30301, and I don't see the word contaminant. I only see the word contamination.
Just give me a second, please. Okay, the contamination exclusion appears at DA 83 for Zurich, DA 253 for AIG Specialty, DA 427 for Interstate Fire and Casualty, and DA 367 for National Fire and Marine. The definition of contaminant, and I can read it.
No, I was just asking where is.
Oh, you're just looking where in the record?
No. So I agree with you that the definition of the word contaminant does not include the word virus. But when I read the exclusion, it only uses the word contamination. It does not use the word contaminant. And the definition of contamination does include the word virus. So I was asking, where in the policy does it actually use the word contaminant in the substantive exclusion rather than the word contamination?
Well, it doesn't use the word virus in the definition of contaminant. That's the problem. It uses it.
I understand. I'm saying the substantive exclusion, which I think is found in 30301, says contamination and any cost due to contamination, including the inability to use or occupy property or any cost of making property safe or suitable for use or occupancy, except as provided in the radioactive contamination coverage of this policy. So I'm saying the exclusion uses the word contamination, and the definition of contamination includes the word virus. So why do we care about the definition of the word contaminant if the exclusion does not use the word contaminant?
Well, because it's confusing to a policyholder. One would think that that contamination would include a contaminant, right? And when you read the definition of contaminant, it doesn't contain the word virus, whereas the definition of contamination does.
There are several words. That's not the only word from the definition of contamination that is also not found in contaminant. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Justice.
Virus is not the only word found in the definition of contamination.
Correct.
That is not found in the definition of contaminant.
That's correct.
So it's not necessarily the case that all of those words fit within the contaminant definition. But to Justice Wiener Apter's point, the word contamination is the word that is encompassed within the exclusion in Section 3.03. And we have a definition very clearly here in Section 7.09, what contamination encompasses, and that's the word that's in the exclusion.
Yes, but the confusing part.
Why is it confusing if word contamination is used in the exclusion section, and the word contamination is defined and it includes virus?
Yes, but when the policy defines contaminant, it doesn't include the word virus.
It also doesn't include pathogen or pathogenic organism.
Yeah, but the Navitz decision relied upon by this court's decision in Navitz, relied upon by Judge Winkelstein, said that these policy exclusions should be narrowly construed.
And here you have the word that's used in the exclusion, which is contamination, with a definition that includes a virus, and you have this entire case premised on a virus. Where's the? Yes, you have contaminant also. Insurance policies certainly include sometimes definitions of terms that aren't the focus of the case and may not even appear in the.
I think the Navitz case decision requires the court to construe these exclusions narrowly, but more importantly, I think what's at issue here are the reasonable expectations of a policyholder reading the policy language.
If it said contamination by a contaminant, then I would totally be with you, because we'd be reading, you know, contamination includes virus, contaminant doesn't. How do we understand this? But it doesn't actually say contaminant in any of the substantive provisions that are being raised in this case.
Okay, so, but all the language of a policy should be given effect and should be interpreted.
So what's left of the word?
And if they decide, if they decided to include a definition for contaminant and not include a virus, don't you think that's confusing to a policyholder?
If all of the words of a policy are to be given meaning, what meaning is left for the words virus and pathogen under your reading of the policy?
Well, Justice, I'm not sure that question, the answer to that question, you know, to me, I'm confused by reading the policy, because I read the exclusion and then I read the definition of contaminant, and there's the word virus appears in the definition of contamination, but not in the definition of contaminant. And so I as a reasonable policyholder would say, oh, well, then it doesn't exclude viruses, because they don't define a virus as a contaminant. You have to read this in a practical, common sense way.
But counsel, this policy, this was agreed to far before the pandemic, and nobody could have anticipated, obviously, a global pandemic occurring. But clearly, the parties had reached an agreement that would include what a virus could do. And these are sophisticated parties.
Well, first of all, let me just address that one point, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record that this is a sophisticated party or that contra pro doesn't apply. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that AC Ocean had any participation in the negotiation or drafting of this policy language. These are standard form policies. So to say, you know, let's not say that because this was a commercial entity purchasing commercial insurance, that it doesn't get the benefit of contra pro. There's absolutely no evidence to that effect. So to say that, I think, is simply misleading and not true. Now, the other thing that...
To say that it's misleading and not true to suggest that this was a commercial policy that was agreed to by a commercial entity?
No, Justice, that's not what I'm saying. This is certainly AC Ocean. This is a commercial policy. But contra pro applies in the context of commercial policies as well. And to deprive Ocean of the benefit of contra pro when there's no evidence in the record at all that it was involved in the drafting or negotiation of the language of the policy, I just think is unfair. They should be given the same benefit of contra pro that non-commercial policyholders receive.
So is that what the case law says?
Well, the case law that the defendants are relying on, are the Oxford Realty case, which never really got to the question because it didn't find an ambiguous, it didn't find that the language in that case was ambiguous. And there's a dissent by Justice Albin. I'm somewhat surprised to find that I agree with Justice Albin, but I do in this case, which says that there's no reason to, there's simply no evidence that the insured was, you know, shouldn't get the benefit of contra pro just because.
Let's assume the standard applies that you were saying should apply. We have one operative word that we're all talking about, and it is not, as Justice Wiener-Raptor pointed out, the word contaminant. It is the word contamination. So, policyholder goes to the definition and finds virus and contamination. The word that you're focused on could have been in this policy, in this section of the policy of the exclusion, but it's not. So you have the word contamination appearing. It's obviously the most critical word. You have a definition that includes viruses, and you have an allegation that is from soup to nuts all about a virus.
You have a definition of contaminant, which doesn't include virus. And to me, that
could be very important if the word contaminant were in the exclusion, but I don't see it.
Justice, are you saying to me that when I read an exclusion clause for contamination, that it doesn't cover contaminants?
I'm not saying anything to you, Mr. Orlovsky. I'm not arguing with you.
Then I'm saying to you, Your Honor, that I don't think you could have a definition of contamination and then have a definition of contaminant, which is inconsistent with the definition of contamination.
So let's follow up on that. I want to follow up on that with you, if I could. Your essential argument is that virus and pathogen or pathogenic organism do not appear in the definition of contaminant, and that leads to confusion, so we shouldn't consider them under contamination. Is that fair?
Yes.
So I did a quick comparison between the two clauses, and I'm looking at the definition for contamination. It refers to the actual presence of any foreign substance. That doesn't appear in the definition of contaminant. Impurity, same. Pollutant does appear. Hazardous material doesn't appear. Poison, toxin, pathogen, pathogenic organism, bacteria, none of those appear in the definition of contaminant. Virus, same. Disease-causing or illness-causing agent, same. Fungus appears. Mold and mildew do not. So under your argument, this policy, the only words that may be considered are pollutant and fungus. Is that a sensible way to read these clauses?
Well, Judge, that's one way to read them. But the other way to read them, which I respectfully suggest, is that the definition of contamination can't be read without can't be interpreted without reading the definition of contaminant. And it's confusing because the contaminant doesn't include virus. Now, interestingly enough, the other insurer, National Fire, had a special virus exclusion, which Judge Winkelstein upheld and granted their motion to dismiss. And in that case, in their exclusion, in the National Fire exclusion, it was clear that viruses were excluded. And I think, you know, that's an interesting contrast, because in the National Fire instance, there could be no confusion because they specifically addressed it. And we're talking about the reasonable expectations of the policy. Now, Justice Patterson is torturing me with the language here. And what I'm hard.
Oh, no, she's not. I've seen other arguments. She's not torturing me.
Just a figure of speech.
What's up with me all the time?
Just a figure of speech.
Who knows what torture is all about?
Well, but you know, I'm just saying that you know, we're parsing the language and forgetting that Navitt's decision of this court says that these pollution exclusion clauses should be narrowly construed.
But wasn't Navitt's in part based on a regulatory estoppel argument that because the insurance industry told the regulators that pollution exclusion clauses at issue would only apply to environmental pollution, they shouldn't be allowed to get away from that? Is there any evidence of anyone?
Well, there is interesting. It's an interesting point. There is some evidence that the Louisiana insurance body, when reviewing this particular exclusion clause presented by Zurich, said that it was inappropriate to. It didn't exclude viruses, and that they should have their own. You know, if you wanted to exclude viruses, you needed a special exclusion. They chose not to do that. National Fire did. And so National Fire got. So there is some aspect.
Navitt's was based, sorry, on New Jersey regulators and statements made to New Jersey regulators.
Look, I understand. You asked the question. It's true that the only regulatory body that raised that question was Louisiana. But, you know, there is an element, at least there is some evidence in the record that a regulator, perhaps not a New Jersey regulator, did look at this language and raise questions about it. And National Fire, unlike Zurich, decided to adopt its own special exclusion, which Judge Winkelstein upheld and granted their motion to dismiss. And I think that illustrates the problem here.
And why was that appropriate for a motion to dismiss under the New Jersey standard? Why was that decision fine?
The National Fire?
The Judge Winkelstein's dismissal of the claims against National Fire.
Let me see if I can find the.
No, I'm not. Why was that? You were saying that none of this should be resolved on a motion to dismiss.
Because that exclusion made it clear that it covered viruses. Let me see if I can find the language.
No, I'm aware of the language. I'm talking about as a procedural matter. You're telling us that a motion to dismiss is not the appropriate procedural stage for a coverage determination in this case. And yet it sounds to me as if you're not disputing.
Yeah, Judge, please don't put words in my mouth.
I'm not.
What I'm saying is that there are disputed facts about whether the claim for coverage falls, that the assertion for coverage falls within the coverage language. That's all I'm saying. When the facts are disputed, it can't be disputed. But let me turn to Justice. Just Judge Finkelstein, Judge Winkelstein's.
No.
Mr. Arnofsky, it's not necessary, and we're a little bit beyond the 15 minutes. We can pass on.
Okay, but I think that's important, because it addresses the point that Justice Patterson is raising, and yes, you can rule on certain coverage claims on a motion to dismiss. And Judge Winkelstein's ruling in favor
of National Fire illustrates that. And what it and if you look at the language of the National Fire exclusion, then you can see the difference and why it's clear on the record, which doesn't, and as a matter of law, that the National Fire exclusion, unlike the Zurich exclusion, clearly excludes viruses.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your argument?
I think, Your Honor, I've exhausted my time, if not the court.
Thank you. Mr. Insua.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Nicholas Insua from Reed Smith for the amicus curiae United policyholders. We move the court for oral argument on 3 points, and I'd like to cover at least those 3 points very briefly right now, possibly in a little different order than we put in our motion to argue. The first is that the pre-pandemic understanding of physical loss or damage was very, very well established before the coronavirus and COVID-19 cases began coming into the courts. And this was over many, many, many years, decades, where courts understood that, as Mr. Orlovsky talked about, fumes, ammonia, asbestos, different types of losses could be considered physical loss or damage under the policy. The policy language was originally called for the trigger of coverage being damage or destruction. It was then broadened to be all risks of physical loss or damage, and was very well understood before the pandemic that could encompass loss of the ability to use the property for its intended use, loss of functionality. That was decades before the pandemic. We then put in the brief statements by insurance companies. We talked about Strathmore and its statements to regulators in New York about the virus exclusion and it not wanting to include a virus exclusion because it wanted to have coverage that would actually ensure viruses. We talked about statements of FM being one of the largest first party property insurers in the world, statements by FM that viruses could trigger coverage under these all risk policies. And we also put some statements in our brief from AIG, Cincinnati Insurance Company, that talked about at the beginning of the pandemic, talked about that these claims could potentially trigger coverage under the policy.
When you're referring to well-settled understanding that any loss of function would suffice, are you relying primarily on Wake Fern and on the Appellate Division custom distribution case, or are there other cases from other jurisdictions that you're relying on?
So there are other cases from other jurisdictions, but certainly under New Jersey law, custom distribution, Wake Fern, Gregory Packaging, Port Authority, which is decided under New Jersey law, all of these decisions before the
Port Authority reads to me like it's a different standard. It does read like it's requiring complete uninhabitability, especially as to asbestos. It says, you know, if the building is completely uninhabitable, then that could be covered. But if only certain parts of the building are not usable, then that wouldn't trigger the policy. But it seems also, so you're saying it's all the same standard?
I believe it's all part of the same standard, which is that it's you lose the ability to use the property for its intended purpose. You've lost its functionality. I mean, essentially, it's the same thing.
Do any of those involve government shutdown orders analogous to what occurred during the COVID pandemic?
I believe, if I recall correctly, Your Honor, Gregory Packaging involved a closure where the building was shut down because of the amount of ammonia that was found, and it was deemed that it couldn't be used.
Shut down by government order?
I believe it was, Your Honor, but that there was an order to close it. I would also just mention very briefly that in the supplemental brief of the defendants, they say that, you know, you don't need to look at, especially the statements of the other insurance companies. This is extrinsic evidence, but the court has regularly looked at information to provide context and circumstances that would surround interpreting policy language. More international NAVITS we've been talking about, where regulatory history was looked at. And we know that in the restatement second of contracts, courts should always look at not only express terms, course of performance, course of dealing, use of the trade, technical terms, and terms of art should be given their meaning in a particular industry. The second point I want to just briefly touch on is that a little bit out of order, which is something that Mr. Orlovsky talked about, which is a sophisticated policyholder and whether this is an exception that's been recognized by this court. We believe it has not. In the Oxford case cited by the defendants, as Mr. Orlovsky said, there was no finding that a rule of construction had to be implied, and therefore there was no need to apply an exception to a rule of construction. We're not aware of any decision of this court that has applied a quote-unquote sophisticated policyholder standard. We don't believe that that's the law of the state. We don't believe that's the majority rule. We've cited in our papers the restatement of the law of liability insurance. We've talked about decisions, NAVITS and other decisions where rules of construction have been applied, even though lots of insurance is purchased and there could be arguments about whether the policyholder was sophisticated or not. And leaving aside whether a standard has been adopted by this court, which it hasn't, even if it were, we don't know what the standard is. We don't know what the parameters of it would be. Is a sophisticated policyholder just based on how many locations it has, revenue? Does it have a risk management department? Do those people have to be trained in risk management? Does it have to have in-house counsel? Does it have to have worked with a broker? Does it have to have worked with a large broker, or can a small broker on the corner suffice? We don't know anything about what that would be, and there's certainly no evidence in this record about any of those factors. And so we believe that there should be no application of a sophisticated policyholder standard. The third point, which I'll talk about, which is the second point actually in our motion for argument, is the couch section, which is section 148:46. And that was the section where the authors of the section said that physical loss or damage meant demonstrable or physical alteration of the property. They said that this was the established rule. But as it turned out, when that was first published in the early to mid-1990s, that was in fact not the established rule. And all the precedent from other jurisdictions we talked about did not talk about physical alteration being a requirement of physical loss or damage. Those words don't appear in the policy. The policy says all risks of physical loss or damage. It doesn't say all risks of physical alteration or demonstrable alteration. As well, this court and courts before the pandemic in New Jersey have not adopted a physical alteration requirement. And so even if other courts in other states have previously or during the pandemic adopted this standard and said that physical loss or damage requires a physical alteration, this court has not, and therefore it needn't be bound by those other decisions, nor need to be bound by decisions of this state, which have said or suggested that's a standard when this court has not, in fact, adopted that standard.
Does the United Policyholders have a position on the applicability of the contamination exclusion to COVID?
To COVID in this case?
In this case.
Yes. Our position would be that it does not apply. Under NAVITS, exclusions like that are meant to be construed narrowly and applied to instances of traditional environmental contamination. That is not what this was. And this is not the facts here, but if there was a dumping of medical waste and the medical waste somehow had or contained virus and then that cause a loss, maybe that would be excluded. That's not what happened here. This is a global pandemic that no one.
So your contention on behalf of United policyholders is that this contamination exclusion should be limited to environmental pollution.
Yes, and I would also point out that in NAVITS dealt with a loss related to fumes. The exclusion in NAVITS contained the word fumes, and the court still held that the exclusion wouldn't necessarily apply unless it was an instance of traditional environmental contamination.
So do you disagree that NAVITS was based on some sort of theory of regulatory estoppel or the fact that the insurance industry had specifically told regulators that the pollution exclusion at issue would only apply to environmental pollution?
I would distinguish NAVITS and Morton. In Morton, the court established essentially a cause of action for regulatory estoppel. As I read NAVITS, I see the court saying that we're looking at regulatory history to glean the meaning of these words, just as you might look at what Strathmore said or what FM said, so we can understand what these words mean. And they looked at the words, and they looked at what was said to regulators, and there was a determination made that this should be read narrowly.
Why would it apply beyond that circumstance? So just because in a particular circumstance, insurance companies say a particular thing to regulators and therefore they should be held to what they said. Here, if there is no similar history, why are we applying the same rule?
So a couple of things. First, that I believe the Morton decision, which dealt with sudden and accidental pollution exclusions, that holding that it would apply to only traditional environmental pollution applied to other types of pollution exclusions that didn't use the exact same language, because the court held that these exclusions needed to be read narrowly.
And that's a pollution exclusion?
That was a sudden and accidental pollution exclusion, yes.
But we're not talking, this is a contamination exclusion.
It does say contamination, but I think that given that it has the word pollutants in it and toxins, that it is more of more akin to a pollution exclusion and should be consistently with the court's prior decisions.
So can insurance companies not do anything to have an exclusion that is beyond environmental exclusion, even if at this point they've directly told regulators this is not only for traditional environmental hazards, we are trying to exclude all viruses because it's going to continue to use the word pollution somewhere in the exclusion? NAVITS will always say that it has to only apply to environmental pollution.
Well, there is a virus exclusion. There's a specific virus exclusion that ISO drafted and was put before regulators, and that was specific and said essentially viruses isn't insured under this policy. It wasn't in the context of all these other types of losses, including pollutants, and then a list afterwards. It just is an exclusion, and that's what the discussion in our briefs about Strathmore, right? There was a specific virus exclusion, and Strathmore said we don't want to have to put this on our policy because we want to be able to provide coverage for virus events.
So when we see in the definition of contamination, pathogen, pathogenic organism, bacteria, virus, the only effect of those words is if viruses, bacteria, pathogens are in medical waste that ends up being polluting. That's how we're supposed to read those.
I would think words. That was an example I gave, but if it was in some context that could be considered a event of traditional environmental contamination or pollution, I think that this exclusion might apply. But that's not what this is.
I think we have your position. And other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Two housekeeping matters, and before we move on, for everyone, we're going to break. Please have a seat. We're going to break at around 12:30. I don't know whether the argument will be completed at that point or not, but I wanted to allow all counsel to prepare for that. And to the extent counsel on this side of the aisle are able to incorporate arguments from one another, please do so. Our break will be around 30 minutes. Mr. Roth.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dave Roth for American Guarantee and Liability Insurance Company.
May it please the court, the appellate division's dismissal of Ocean Walk's complaint should be affirmed for two reasons. First, Ocean Walk didn't allege facts that amount to direct physical loss of or damage, which is required for all the coverages at issue in this case. And second, even if it had alleged physical loss or damage, coverage would be barred by the contamination exclusion, which explicitly includes virus. I'd like to begin with the physical loss issue. As the appellate division held in the Mac Property Group case, the ordinary meaning of that phrase, physical loss of or damage to property, is that property has suffered a detrimental physical alteration of some kind, or there's been a physical loss of the insured property. And that plain ordinary meaning is reinforced by the period of liability provision, which makes clear that physical loss or damage to property means something requiring repairs or replacement of the property in order to restore it to its pre-loss condition. Now, Mac Property isn't alone in interpreting the words that way. 10 appellate division panels have unanimously agreed with Mac Property. 14 state Supreme Courts have considered what these words mean in this exact context. They've all come to the exact same conclusion, as has the Wilson Court, the Third Circuit, applying New Jersey law, and every other numbered federal circuit. So once you establish that what that those words mean, what direct physical loss over damaged property is, Ocean's Walk's claims fail. So they have essentially two theories that are in their briefs, and they took them a little bit out of order today, but what they characterize as their main theory in their brief is that they lost the intended use of their property due to the government orders or the pandemic. Specifically, they couldn't use their property for in-person gaming or there were restrictions on its use. And the basic problem with that theory is that that's simply not a physical loss. The loss of particular intended use of property, the loss of a legal right, an economic right, it's not a tangible loss of property. They haven't been physically deprived of it. No different from any other government regulation or order which may impair how a policyholder uses its property. And that's particularly so in this case because this policy contains explicit exclusions for loss of use and explicit exclusions for loss due to government orders regulating the occupancy or use of property. Every state Supreme Court, now 14 and counting, that's looked at this issue has held that the loss of intended use of property due to the pandemic is not a physical loss. It's not covered on a property under a policy like this one. And so they've rejected under that theory. Today, they focus mostly on what they characterize as a second theory of their complaint, which is that the virus was actually present at their property and caused physical damage. Specifically, their guests or employees exhaled virus particles. Those virus particles hung in the air and fell on surfaces. And were in the property, and that amounts to physical damage. Now, assuming that virus particles were actually present in their casino, and their allegations are fairly vague about that, the key is what impact those virus particles actually had. And the only fact they plead in the complaint is simply that microscopic virus particles rested on the surface of their property. They don't plead that those virus particles caused some discernible alteration, that it made the property change colors, that it emitted an odor. They don't plead that it caused some sort of invisible harm, that it caused the property to degrade and deteriorate. They don't allege that they had to repair or replace a single item in the property. And they concede that those virus particles became inert and harmless in hours or at most days. Now, courts in other states have consistently agreed with the appellate division that allegations a virus particle was ephemerally present in property without causing any tangible alteration on it and abating within a matter of hours or days simply doesn't meet the ordinary definition of physical damage. The Third Circuit reached that result in Wilson under New Jersey law. 9 state Supreme Courts now with the Nevada Supreme Court have concluded the same thing. Ordinary meaning of physical damage is the same in New Jersey as it is in all those other states, so there's no reason that this court should disagree. I want to talk a little bit about the pleading standards. A lot of their arguments sounded like the assertion that so long as they assert the presence of a virus is physical damage, this court is bound to accept that for the purposes of a motion to dismiss, and then we have the case proceeds to discovery. And that just fundamentally misunderstands the issue on appeal and the issue facing the court at a motion to dismiss. The question is what direct physical loss of or damage means. That's a legal question about the interpretation of a contract. And it's also a legal question whether a particular set of assumed facts meet that definition. So their assertion that those facts satisfy the legal definition is just a legal conclusion. And that's not entitled to the presumption of truth. You instead look at what they actually allege about the virus's impact on their property. The only thing they allege is that a virus particle was there, and that does not meet the definition of physical damage. So so the appellate division was right to find that these allegations were simply legally inadequate. It was not resolving factual disputes against them.
The facts that we should assume the truth of for purposes of the motion to dismiss are the facts about what actually occurred. In other words, that there was a virus present, the COVID pandemic, and I assume we should assume as true the allegations with respect to the government closures as well.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, so the actual facts that they plead, so what the virus did to their property, the fact that they shut down on particular days, those facts you have to accept as true. But whether those facts meet the definition or fall within the scope of physical loss or damage, as those terms are used in this policy, that's a legal question.
So when your adversary refers to a fact that we need to assume to be true, using the policy language, you're saying that's actually a legal conclusion that we need not accept as true. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. So the ultimate question is, do these facts amount to physical damage within the meaning of this policy? And that is a legal question. It's what does physical damage mean? What facts are physical damage? And simply asserting that a particular set of facts amount to physical damage is not enough. If that were enough, as Your Honor was indicating, it's hard to imagine how any motion to dismiss could ever be granted, not only in an insurance case, but in, you know, a breach of contract case, in a statutory interpretation case. Seems that the upshot of their argument is so long as a plaintiff alleges a particular set of facts satisfies some legal term, well, you have to assume that's true and proceed to discovery. And that's not how, you know, this court understands pleading standards. As it's made clear, you have to plead the essential facts, and then whether those essential facts create a cause of action is a legal question. And so it's really no different than any other breach of contract context.
Outside of COVID, are there cases that have dealt, assuming pre-COVID, with government closures and situations where a building has become unusable for asbestos or for some more traditional environmental reason? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But also coupled with a government closure. Obviously, you have government remediation orders that occur all the time in that type of situation. But we're dealing here with something different, which is you must close on this date. You must cease to do business on this date. Everybody across the board must do so that are normally admitting the public.
So I'm not aware of a context that's exactly like this one, but there are pre-COVID cases dealing with government shutdown orders, and courts consistently held that the interference with the use of property due to a shutdown order or something like that is not a physical loss. And I'd start with a decision from the New York Appellate Division Roundabout. That's a case where there was the policyholder was a theater. There was a construction accident down the street. The construction accident didn't actually damage the theater, but as a result of the accident, the authorities shut down the entire street. And because the street was shut down, the theater couldn't have performances for a period of time. So it sued, it alleged that's a physical loss of its property. We couldn't use the property as we intended because of this shutdown order. New York Appellate Division unanimously held that's not a physical loss.
I'm sure Mr. Orlovsky would ably distinguish that, obviously, because it wasn't dealing with a situation where there's a hazard within the property. Is there anything closer to that? And I'm just envisioning there's just too much asbestos in a particular location. You have to shut down the building now and keep it closed until we tell you otherwise. Is there anything like that in any of these coverage cases that you're aware of?
So there were the pre-COVID coverage cases involving, you know, contamination of the premises. And as some of the questioning was talking about, you know, things like asbestos, ammonia contamination and the like. And those have been discussed by many of the COVID cases. Wilson talked about them at length. The recent Nevada Supreme Court decision talked about them at length. All of those cases involve situations where, you know, you're dealing with a substance that's actually physically in the property. There's asbestos in the walls. There is ammonia leaking out of a pipe. And that substance is making the property uninhabitable and unusable until you bring in specialized remediation to restore the property. You have to, you know, tear out the walls, remove the asbestos using trained hazmat crews in order to restore the property to usability. And some courts have suggested that that might be a physical loss because there's essentially a dispossession. Now, we don't have that here in multiple respects. First of all, we're not complaining about some condition of the property. What the reason why COVID virus is there is because their patrons and guests come in and they exhale virus particles. Those particles don't make the property uninhabitable and unusable. We know that because all manner of property remained open throughout the pandemic. Grocery stores, factories, even liquor stores remained open. So whatever impact COVID-19 virus has on property doesn't amount to uninhabitability. And we particularly know that here given what they specifically allege. So they allege they closed on March 16th in compliance with, that's a direct quote from their complaint, the executive order that day, issued that day, requiring casinos like Ocean Walk to close to the public. They remained closed until July 2nd, when in compliance with, again a quote, the governor's executive order, they reopened to the public. So the only time period when they weren't able to operate their casino and be open to the public was when the governor required them to be closed. Other than that, there is no allegation that the virus ever did anything to their property that made them physically incapable of operating. And plainly, if it did have that sort of physical impact, they would not have been open on July 3rd, 2020. They would not have been open for the last 3 years. So there's simply no way to read this complaint and see an allegation that the virus had a physical impact on their property that made it uninhabitable and unusable. There's also no allegation that they had to undertake some kind of repairs or remediation in order to restore the property to usable condition to remove the virus. That's not in the complaint. And we simply know that's not true because, as they concede in paragraph 114, the virus becomes inert and harmless on its own in a matter of days. So even if they had done nothing at all, the virus would abate. And that's just not like the situations involving, you know, asbestos contamination, the release of ammonia, et cetera, as cases like Wilson have explained.
What about the allegations in paragraphs 118 and 19, where they allege coronavirus causes direct physical loss and damage to property, and that the risk of significant damage to persons is why it was necessary to close the space?
So there's no allegation of what the actual physical damage is. And if you go through the entire complaint, I think the only allegation you will see of some kind of real alteration of their property or supposed real alteration of their property is in paragraph 113, where they say the virus altered their property because microscopic particles were resting on it. So that's the only essential fact that is pled here. A virus particle rested on this property. That is what they say amounts to physical alteration.
But didn't the Gregory decision that you referenced before hold that property can sustain a physical loss or damage without experiencing any structural alteration?
So that's something that Gregory Packaging says, but it's a situation where there is a release of a dangerous substance from the facility. That substance not only requires the property itself to be evacuated, in that case, an entire 1 mile radius around the factory had to be evacuated. And there was a concession agreement by both parties in that case that the property in question could not be used. It was completely uninhabitable and unusable for a week until specialized remediation efforts had restored the property to usability. So that is a case where there was an assumption that the property was rendered uninhabitable and unusable due to the condition of the release of a substance, and we don't have that here.
In terms of the fact that the ammonia released from the structure itself, from the pipe, rather than patrons coming in and breathing ammonia, are you saying that that makes a difference for purposes of the policy? So the structure, the physical damage to the structure has to be caused by the structure itself and cannot be caused by patrons causing damage?
So that's something that the Nevada Supreme Court found very significant in its decision just last week. Ultimately, this is a property insurance policy. It's looking to whether there's been physical loss over damage to property. And so it's quite logical that you would look to whether there's actually a condition of the property itself that is creating the danger. If the risk is something that really isn't related to the property in any material respect, that certainly suggests that it's not actually physical damage, it's not actually physical loss that would be covered by a property insurance policy.
You could have physical losses to property that originate from outside the property, like someone comes in and damages the property, and that would be covered. In other words, it doesn't have to originate in the actual structure of the building, does it?
No, but in those cases, you have a physical alteration. The property has been, physically altered by that external force. It's changed its structure. It's burned down the walls, whatever. And that's, again, what we just don't have that here, other than this allegation that a microscopic particle rested on the surface for a couple hours.
We're using 2020 hindsight to evaluate that. Setting aside the executive order, if the executive order hadn't existed, and what we knew about the coronavirus at the time, that we didn't know how fast it could spread from surface to person and from person to person. If their position had been to close the casino on their own, based on the fact that the existing science was that there was some quick spreading nature to this and that it could go from surface to individual, and that had been their choice independent of the executive order, because it was preventing them from safely having individuals use their tables because of the possibility of the microscopic particles remaining there for longer than days, hours, weeks, we didn't know at that time. Would that change your argument at all if that had been what was pled?
No, that situation would not be covered either. And the easiest way is just to walk through the policy. So this case is mostly about what's called time element coverage, which covers the lost income policyholder may experience when it suspends its operations. But the policy explicitly says, and this is section 4.1.1, it only applies when the suspension is due to physical loss or damage to the property. And the policy explicitly excludes suspensions of business for any other reason, and that's in section 3.3.2.5. So the question is, not did they suspend their business? It's did they suspend their business because of some physical alteration of their property? And if they suspend their business because of some, concern or some fear, that is not covered. The alteration of its property itself would need to be the cause of the closure. And here they...
But in my hypothetical, the idea was that at the time when the building was closed, it was because the microscopic particles that existed on the surfaces made them unusable for their intended purpose, which was to have people surrounding them.
So first, Your Honor, the loss of intended purpose is not a physical loss. It's not physical damage. There needs to be a tangible alteration of the property. So what that sort of coverage provision exists for is, the situation where there is, say, a fire in a restaurant. And the base insuring agreement is going to cover the physical damage itself. And then provisions like the time element coverage, what they do is they cover the lost income if that fire forces the policyholder to close, to suspend their operations. But again, that suspension has to be caused by the physical damage itself. If you suspend your business for some other reason, just a general concern about safety or whatever, that's not caused by any physical damage, any physical alteration to the property. It's not caused by any physical dispossession of the property. So that is not covered.
Now, your adversary says we should allow discovery to go forward because there's a factual dispute as to why the facilities were closed. What's your response to that?
Well, I frankly don't see how there can be a factual dispute given that they explicitly allege they closed on March 16th in compliance with a government order issued that day requiring them to close. They explicitly plead that they opened on July 2nd in compliance with a government order issued that day allowing them to reopen. And other than that period, there is no allegation in this complaint that they were ever forced to close due to anything, and much less due to any physical alteration or physical loss of their property. So their own complaint pleads why they closed. Their own complaint pleads that they closed in compliance with the government order, not
they say that there were multiple reasons and that the governor's executive order was but one of them?
The only thing they say in their complaint is the governor's order and the risks of the pandemic. So the general, you know, risk of the spread of the virus in society.
And in paragraph 130, they say including direct physical loss of or damage to covered property.
But they don't allege any essential facts of what that is. There's the only allegation of physical alteration of their property is, you know, the virus particles being present on it. They explicitly plead that that persisted after they reopened. So any, you know, whatever the virus particles doing on the property, however you characterize that, there is no allegation that that caused them to close in this complaint. And if it did cause them to close, they wouldn't be open on July 3rd. They wouldn't have been open for the last 3 years.
But isn't that a dispute of fact as to whether the property was uninhabitable? And it seems like you paid, or you and your co-defendants paid $850,000 under the communicable disease provision, which I thought in reading says that it would only apply if, quote, the premises was declared uninhabitable due to the threat of the spread of communicable disease prohibiting access to those portions of the location. So how does paying that, which to me seems like conceding that it was uninhabitable, square with the argument that it was, they're not alleging any facts that it was uninhabitable?
So a couple points on that, Your Honor. So first, that interruption by communicable disease provision, that's a optional form of coverage that they elected to purchase in this case. And as Your Honor indicated, we paid the limit of liability under that provision. So whether there's coverage under that provision is not something that's actually at issue here. Now, the key, though, to that provision is that unlike all the coverages we're talking about today, it doesn't require that there be physical loss or damage to the property. It doesn't require that there be that any loss be due to a covered cause of loss, which is what incorporates that contamination exclusion that I'd like to talk about in a little bit. So because that coverage isn't triggered by physical loss or damage, you know, whether that provision was triggered doesn't bear on whether there was physical loss or damage.
Sorry, so are you arguing that even if a building is uninhabitable, you still would not pay because that's now not physical loss or damage? I thought before we had established that the case law establishes that if a building is made uninhabitable, then that is a physical loss or damage to the building.
Yes. So if there is some, you know, physical alteration or some presence of contaminants in the building that makes it completely uninhabitable and unusable until there's remediation, some courts have said that may be enough for physical loss or damage. The interruption by communicable disease coverage does not require physical loss or damage. So,
but it does say that the location has to be uninhabitable. So that's what I'm not understanding. If uninhabitable equals physical loss or damage, then once you say it's uninhabitable, aren't you also saying you have the required physical loss or damage?
So it doesn't say that it has to be uninhabitable due to the presence of a substance. It has to be uninhabitable due to some alteration of it. It says it, that it has to be declared uninhabitable due to the by a government order due to the spread of a disease. So, you know, if the authorities issue an order because of the nationwide or New Jersey-wide spread of a disease that makes their property unusable, that may trigger the interruption by communicable disease coverage. But as far as whether their property has been physically lost or damaged, then there needs to actually be some sort of contamination of the premises that specifically makes their property uninhabitable and unusable. It's not looking to some government decree. It's looking to the actual physical condition of the property. And that's what they don't have in this complaint.
So did you pay on that aspect of the coverage because your client viewed the government orders to be a declaration that the property was uninhabitable by virtue of the COVID pandemic?
So there's no facts in the complaint about why we pled it. My understanding is that it was, or excuse me, why we paid it. My understanding is that we paid it because the government orders declared their property uninhabitable due to the statewide, nationwide spread of the pandemic, not because of any physical condition of their property itself. It's the government orders that are the source of that coverage being paid. A second point, Your Honor, on this is by paying that coverage, That is not a concession of any legal conclusions. It is not a concession of any facts. They believe that they're entitled to coverage because they suffered physical loss or damage. They need to plead facts that amount to physical loss or damage. And by paying some different coverage with different coverage terms, we are not admitting anything as to whether they suffered physical loss or damage under a completely different set of policy provisions.
And your argument is that the physical loss or damage can only be proven by physical alteration to the property?
Well, there could also be a physical loss if there is a physical dispossession. You know, a theft, for example, would be a physical loss.
Here we're generally talking about some kind of alteration would have needed to be pleaded in your argument, correct?
In order for there to be physical damage, there would need to be some actual alteration of the property that is alleged, that alteration that requires repairs or replacement in order to restore the property to its pre-loss condition.
Isn't that the allegation? The allegation is that the microscopic particles changed the nature of the property by making it dangerous rather than a usable entertainment vehicle.
Well, that's something that the New Hampshire Supreme Court talked about at some length, Your Honor. The question isn't whether there was a danger from the property. It's not whether there was a risk to people using the property. It's whether the property itself has been physically altered. So it may well be that the virus particles posed a risk to humans, that they could catch a disease, but they did not tangibly alter the property in any material way, requiring it to be repaired and replaced. And that's why there's fundamentally no
allegation. Why is radon different from that? In other words, it's a radon, as I understand, the danger of it is to people who may be nearby. It doesn't, or in the building, it does not physically alter walls or drywall or whatever it may be.
So that's coming into the contamination cases, Your Honor. And you know, the presence of radon could possibly give rise to a physical loss if there's radon emanating from the structure and it's so severe that it makes the building uninhabitable and unusable until it's remediated.
Even though it's not like flood damage, fire damage, it doesn't damage the walls, the ceiling, the structure of the building that requires a repair in order to be eliminated. It's just in the air, and I don't mean to make any statements about radon here. I'm just using that as an example and asking you to tell us why this is different.
So radon would arguably be different, and I don't know of any cases dealing with radon. I assume there probably are some, but radon would arguably be different because it's I think it's coming out of the ground. The radon particles physically come from the ground underneath the structure. And
not from a person.
They're not coming from a person. They need to be remediated in order to restore the property to usable and inhabitable status. And we just don't have any of that here. We don't have some substance that's coming out of the building. We don't have it making the building uninhabitable and unusable. We don't have a need for remediation to restore it to usability. So it's not a physical loss of possession. And this is what the Third Circuit talked about in the Wilson case. The logic of those contamination cases is that the presence of that substance makes the property uninhabitable and unusable and essentially dispossesses the policyholder of that property. So that's a physical loss.
Here they are arguing that COVID did make the property uninhabitable. So that's what I'm not understanding. It seems like you're conceding that if the property is made uninhabitable by some sort of substance, then it can be a direct physical loss. Here, that's what they're alleging, that COVID made the property uninhabitable.
If they do not have any allegations in their complaint that the virus physically altered their property or physically made their property uninhabitable, the only period of time they were not able to operate their property is when, or were not able to conduct in-person gaming at their casino is when the governor's orders required them to close.
So in Justice Patterson's example of a radon, or for example, in the Gregory packaging, where I think that one is the ammonia one. If OSHA comes in and says the radon level in this building is too high, you cannot use this building for the next 30 days. We'll come check in 30 days whether you have remediated it enough. Does that automatically exclude coverage because OSHA acknowledged that the building was uninhabitable because of the radon?
So that's a much different scenario than here, because then you're dealing with an order that's issued because of the physical condition of that specific property. We're not dealing with that here. This is an executive order that was issued by Governor Murphy because of the spread of COVID throughout the entire country and throughout New Jersey. It's not directed at Ocean Walk's property. It's not directed at any specific condition of Ocean Walk's property. It applies to every single casino, every single restaurant in the state. So it's a generalized government order, not responding to some physical condition, just like countless government regulations that would affect the use of property. You know, you can imagine zoning restrictions, noise ordinances, changes in gaming law that might make it no longer feasible to operate a casino. All of those may impair the intended use of the property, but they're not physically dispossessing the owner of it. They're not physically altering the property, and so they're not a physical loss.
We'll move on to the contamination exclusion. Are there other questions in this area?
Sure, Your Honor. So the second reason why the appellate division's decision should be affirmed is contamination exclusion. As you noted, it excludes coverage for contamination and any cost due to contamination, including the inability to use or occupy property. And it explicitly defines contamination as any condition of the property due to the presence of any virus.
So Mr. Orlovsky tells us that contaminant throws a proverbial monkey wrench into this by not including virus and the other sort of related words that are in the contamination exclusion. And therefore, that creates ambiguity. And the insured is not put on notice as to what is and what is not within the policy. Why is he wrong?
He's wrong because the word contaminant is not used in the contamination exclusion at all. If someone wants to understand what the contamination exclusion excludes, they would simply look at the definition of contamination and see that it is explicitly defined as any condition of property due to the actual presence of any virus. Nothing in that exclusion's language suggests that it's limited to traditional environmental pollution. It's not a pollution exclusion. It doesn't use terms of art that might suggest pollution, you know, discharge, dispersal, escape. And half the substances that are present and listed as examples of contamination are disease-causing substances that are not ordinarily associated with environmental pollution. So
is contaminant in the policies somewhere else?
Yeah, so contaminant is used in the policy in several specialized grants of coverage. So coverage is granted for certain instances involving contaminants. For example, there's a provision for, I believe it's land and water debris cleanup or something like that. And so the definition is somewhat tailored to those specific grants of coverage, which is why this policy defined contaminant in a slightly different way than contamination. But ultimately, if you want to understand what contamination means, you simply look at the definition. It's defined in no uncertain terms, any condition of property due to the actual presence of any virus. And we'd submit that's exactly what it means and exactly how it should be applied here.
We shouldn't be concerned with all of the terms listed as contaminants in reading the contamination exclusion policy, as Mr. Orlovsky has indicated that there's some confusion that is results from all of these different terms being used in contamination and in the term contaminant, because contaminant is used in other portions of the policy that have nothing to do with the exclusion policy, the exclusion provision that we're discussing.
Yes, essentially that, Your Honor. It's a separate provision used in other parts of the policy. If you want to understand what the contamination exclusion means, you simply look at the definition. The mere fact that you know a related word is used in a different context in the policy doesn't import ambiguity when contamination is explicitly defined as any condition of property due to the actual presence of any virus.
Would it be a different analysis if contaminant didn't appear anywhere else, and it's only possible there's a definition there, the only possible, hypothetically, the only possible relevance to this policy would be it's that contaminant is a related word to contamination?
It might be different, but I think you would really have to use the word contaminant in this specific contamination exclusion in order for there to be ambiguity. So, you know, you have a fairly explicit definition as to what contamination is. It plainly encompasses viruses, plainly encompasses all sorts of disease-causing agents, and there's just no way to read that as, you know, essentially read those words out of the policy because of some other word that's not actually used in that provision.
Perhaps after the break, counsel can tell us where else it appears in the policy. Is there anything else you'd like to present as we approach 12:30?
I had one more question on that. I'm so sorry. Oh. What about your adversary's argument that regardless of what the policy says under NAVITS, it can only apply to traditional environmental pollution, and that's not this case?
So NAVITS is a case about the meaning of a specific pollution hazard exclusion that's found in some commercial liability policies. Now, this isn't a commercial liability policy. It's a completely different type of policy. This isn't a pollution hazard exclusion. It's a contamination exclusion. Essentially, Navitz is a holding about what that particular exclusion means, so it doesn't apply to every exclusion that could possibly be in an insurance policy that in any way relates to pollution or contamination. Navitz itself explicitly relied on the fact that the pollution hazard exclusion in that case contained words that denoted traditional environmental pollution. It is, after all, a pollution hazard exclusion. It used terms like seepage, dispersal, escape that are terms of art for environmental pollution. And it principally relied on the regulatory estoppel doctrine, which is that in the context of that case, insurers had apparently represented that that exclusion would be limited to traditional environmental pollution. It would not apply to the release of pollutants that was inherent in the policyholder's business. That's the exact context that the insurer tried to apply the exclusion in the case of Navitz. And this court held that since insurers had represented it wouldn't apply in that factual circumstance, insurers were stopped from asserting that it did. There's no allegations of anything like that here. There's no evidence of anything like that here. So that whole regulatory estoppel piece of Navitz is absent. Ultimately, this court has affirmed several times, exclusions are an integral part of the insurance contract, and they have to be enforced when their meaning is clear, holding essentially that any exclusion that relates to pollution must, as a matter of law, be limited to traditional environmental pollution would be a drastic alteration of the ordinary contract interpretation principles that go into interpreting exclusions. Be happy to address any other points, but if not, we'll rest on our briefs.